Islamic director Dia Khan spent the most recent part of her career looking at extremism in both white supremacist movements as well as Islamic groups. She's the daughter of an Afghani mother and Pakistani father, born in Norway. She's also been involved with human rights activism through her debut film about an honour killing of a British Kurdish woman. Her latest television documentary, White Right, Meeting the Enemy, involved her interviewing committed white supremacists in the US, who then invited her to attend the now infamous Charlottesville rally.
My hair okay? It's not flying around in 20 directions.
So as you know, I am a woman of colour.
Yes.
Yes. I am the daughter of immigrants. Mm-hmm. I am a Muslim. Mm-hmm. I am a feminist. I am a lefty liberal.
I wouldn't have ever guessed. I see your face.
And what I want to ask you mm-hmm. is, am I your enemy?
I wonder what he said next. That's a cut from White Flight or White Right, Meeting the Enemy by Dia Khan. She spoke with us a few days ago. The dangers of dealing with extremists and what she's learned from them.
Thank you so much for having me.
You must be a brave person.
Not necessarily. I think I'm just obsessively curious. And I think I'm just really desperate to try and understand why people do the things that they do. So the bravery part of it doesn't really, at least in my mind, it doesn't really factor in or even come into play. Mm. Until I'm, you know, right in the middle of a riot,
yeah.
realizing that, you know, maybe this wasn't such a great idea after all.
I want to start asking you about your reaction to what happened here in New Zealand back in March, on March the 15th, and when you first heard about that news. What were your thoughts, bearing in mind the work you've already done?
Utterly, utterly devastated, to be honest. But at the same time, as horrified as I felt, having spent time with some of the white supremacists in America that I had for at least about a year, in one way, I wasn't completely surprised, because I walked away from doing that film feeling in some ways more hopeful. Because I felt that there is some possibility of change, some possibility of, you know, perhaps the rest of society being able to reach men like that. But on the other hand, I also left the film feeling quite scared and quite worried about the fact that more violence is on the horizon. And the you know, what I saw at Charlottesville was just the tip of the iceberg. And many of the neo-Nazis that I spoke to who marched there were very, very clear about that this is just the beginning of the violence that you will see. Mm. And here we are.
When you heard that news, did you immediately build a picture in your mind of who this probably is? And did it turn out to be that person or that character?
You know, I didn't necessarily think about him so much as the rest of us. And you know, how do we, you know, hate and violence is not something that's new necessarily. But so what I immediately started thinking about is, what do we do? How should we as a society and as individuals respond to something like this? And then obviously, you know, the response of you know, the people of New Zealand and your political leadership has been just astonishingly brave, inspiring, and you know, what true, I think, leadership looks like. And I think just an extraordinary example of the best of humanity. You know, out of, you know, the darkest, most vicious, most kind of ugly aspects of humanity, you know, the act of this man, you know, from that, seeing the just the extraordinary humanity, I think, of the people of New Zealand has just been incredibly touching. But, you know, in answer to your question, you know, it's, as I say, I wasn't as interested in him in some ways, because I've you know, as I say, you know, I've worked and filmed men like that, so I have some sense of, you know, their sort of emotional and psychological and even socioeconomic makeup of a lot of these guys. But I think what we have to do is, as this white supremacist movement continues to rise and gain traction internationally, I think the more important focus needs to be, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to engage with it? And are we just going to sort of judge them and cast them to one side? Or is there another way of engaging with this to where we can see if it's possible to de-radicalize some of these young men or even prevent this type of radicalization to take place to begin with? I mean, the film that I did before the one about white supremacy was about jihadis. So I've sort of worked on both ends of the spectrum of extremism and what that looks like, what kind of men that it draws, and also what these movements are actually satisfying for these men. And it's all really, really basic human needs, you know, like belonging, like a sense of purpose, like wanting to change the world, like wanting to be heard, be seen, to matter. And even if that's in a negative way, you know, it's you know, many of them will be perfectly satisfied with all the negative attention garnered from awful, awful acts. But at least they exist. You know, these are men who feel insignificant and small and invisible and unheard and unseen and forgotten. And once they commit an act like this, they become at the forefront of all of our minds. And suddenly the you know, quote unquote, powerless starts feeling powerful. You know, suddenly these invisible men feel like they're being heard and they're being seen and that they're relevant. Suddenly they become relevant. And that's part of what they're reacting to is many of these guys within this movement are joining this movement because they're struggling to sort of find their place in a very fast-changing world where they feel like as minorities, as women, as people who have, you know, historically been marginalized, as all of these groups, and I kind of, you know, am one of a part of those groups as well, as, you know, we start to make some progress towards more equality, more, you know, inclusion in the wider society, somehow these men feel that that is at their expense.
Yeah.
That's not the case, but they feel that it's at their expense.
It's interesting you mentioned the other project you did, talking to jihadi young men, and the latest, Meeting the Enemy, which is what white supremacists in the US, again, young men. So you're really saying that there's a commonality, even though they're completely different cultural groups, and all, there's a total commonality. What is that in the way that sort of men are wired up?
It's absolutely. This might sound really counterintuitive, but I've been on the receiving end of death threats from both extremist groups, right? It's one of the reasons why I ended up making both films is that I wanted to not run away and be afraid and hide and react in a way that they want me to react. But I wanted to see, is it possible to sit down with human beings like this and get beyond the rhetoric, get beyond the chest beating and beyond the sort of posturing that they want me to react to? You know, is there a human being behind it? You know, is there any kind of humanity there? And will they be able to recognize mine as well when we sit face to face, up close and personal? And what was really interesting to me is, you know, having received the death threats and then also having spent time with these men, I constantly keep telling my friends that it's as if it's the same guy. You know, the window dressing in terms of their ideology, it might look different. You know, they might be waving different flags and different symbols, but really the guy at the center of it, the type of guy that is drawn to it, and the reasons why he is drawn to an extremist movement, and the reason why he's also targeted often by extremist groups and recruiters, is all the same basic fundamental human needs that are not being met in other parts of their lives that then they find satisfaction through violence and through hatred and through these very, very extreme manifestations of what it means to be, you know, angry, young, disaffected, and somebody who's seeking glory, seeking to affect change in the world, seeking to become relevant in this world that they feel is leaving them behind.
Interesting. I haven't watched the program, but I've watched some of the clips from it, and some of the men that you talk to are obviously different from your average guy. They look different. They look really hard. They have particular looks to them. Am I right about that?
Some of them, yes. I mean, some of them, you know, pride themselves on visibly separating themselves out from your average guy. You know, they want to be sort of hyper masculine, hyper dangerous, hyper sort of. They want to come across as strong and aggressive and somebody that you shouldn't mess with. Somebody that will not tolerate any kind of humiliation. And actually, humiliation and shame is something absolutely core to both movements as well. It's men who don't don't know how to cope with a sense of humiliation and a sense of shame and are trying to equalize those really sort of difficult emotional feelings with trying to put on a posture of dominance and violence and aggression. But then, you know, within the white supremacist movement, I also see, so I found those types of boots on the ground, hard-looking neo-Nazis. But then also there was another end of the same spectrum, which was what I call kind of the suit and tie racists. And they were from a completely different class. They were not working class guys. They were elite, came from elite backgrounds, high very, very well-off financially backgrounds. And for them, their reasons for joining these movements was something else. It wasn't necessarily trying to regain their sense of self and regain some dignity that they feel that they've lost, but it was more about power. It's more about becoming famous, gaining notoriety, and being relevant within our kind of popular culture or our political discourse. And men like that were very happy to recruit these younger, disaffected working class guys and taking their anger. And this is on both sides, actually. You'll see recruiters on the jihadi side as well who will take disaffected, marginalized young Muslim men as well, take their anger, take whatever frustrations or alienation or confusion that they even have, and vulnerabilities and sorrow even that they might have about their personal lives and how they fit in or don't fit into the rest of society, direct that anger and rage towards these types of ideologies and towards violence. So it's a very manipulative and a very cynical couple of movements, to be quite honest, I mean, who are actively looking to make cannon fodder out of these young men.
I can't remember the name of the guy that you interview. It's in the trailer. It's at the start, and he's, you know, got a suit on, no tie, but he's looking pretty good, normal sort of looking guy in his late 50s, early 60s. And I think you ask him, am I your enemy? You ask him.
Yes.
And and it's interesting the way he reacts, and I wonder if there's something in this. He sort of says, no, not you personally. But the big picture, the size of the culture, that sort of, you know, the tsunami coming at us is the enemy and it will destroy us. So he was quite able to put you to one side and have you as an individual, but still maintain that belief that he's doomed. And where you come from or what you represent or any other group represents is his destruction.
Yes. It's very interesting because... And you know, your guy in New Zealand very much subscribes to the same sort of thinking, which is that white, especially white men, are being replaced. They think that there is an active plot against them to erase them, to outbreed them, to marginalize them, to make them insignificant and impotent. And you know, some of them will even say that, you know, it's feminism is a part of destroying. You know, they have like this long laundry list of what it is that they're up against. You know, feminism is a part of it. Women's rights is a part of it. Minorities, obviously, refugees, immigrants, anyone who's different, you know, Jewish people, you know, and anyone from, you know, any kind of different sexual orientation as well, that all these variances of human beings are somehow out to actively diminish and destroy the white guy. Yes. So as much as he can look at me and say, well, I don't have anything against you personally per se, but your very existence in my land, everything that I represent, basically is a threat to his way of life, is what he feels. And what's, you know, what was quite frustrating and sort of disheartening is, you know, how so many of these men felt that it has to be either or. That the future that we're looking towards, I mean, because I kept trying to talk to them and say, look, surely the future that we all want is a future that includes all of us, that includes me and includes you, regardless of you know, even the fact that you might hold really, really abhorrent views. Our society still belongs to all of us, and we all have a part to play. We all have a place in it. And surely that's the society that we want to, and the future that we collectively want to work towards. Why does it have to be me or you? Why this sudden divide and this sort of clash of civilizations? You know, why is that the story that we're telling ourselves, that it's me or you? That's not the case. I mean, that's just, it's a false premise. Sadly, but this is what they've convinced themselves of. And also, both movements, again, are absolutely rooted on victimhood, their sense of victimhood. And so they have to position themselves as victims and for the rest of us as oppressors and abusers of them, basically. And that's also how, because they perceive themselves to be victims, is also where violence starts becoming a legitimate means for them to engage with the rest of us, right? So they feel like they are persecuted. As upside down as that might sound, but that's what they believe, and that's why violence in their eyes is actually justified. To them, they are engaging in self-defense, self-preservation. This is a matter of survival for them.
People who are ignorant, who are incredibly secure in their belief, always freak me out, and it seems that some of the people you were talking to were very secure in their ideas. How do they get that secure in what they think? That there's no questioning, there's no other way. There's a lot of ignorance there, but yet they're so secure about what they think.
Well, the security also comes from complete disengagement. Most of most of the ignorance and the security sort of comes from the same place, which is that they actually, in reality, have had very, very little exposure to all the people that they claim to hate. Right. So the only exposure that they've had, the only thing that they know about people like me. So I come from a Muslim background. I'm a brown woman. You know, I am a feminist. You know, I work for human rights. And, you know, I'm a liberal, all blah, 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 all these sort of different labels. So you know, they've never actually, so they hate me and they hate everything that I stand for. And violence against me in their mind is perfectly legitimate. But they've never actually sat down with anyone like me. So the only experience or story that they know about people like me are the stories that they see in the news. So typically what the news will report on is bad news, right? So typically the only time that they, or most of the times that they hear the word Muslim, it will be associated to the jihadis and to terrorism and violence of some kind. So that's what they know of me. That's their sort of relationship to somebody like me. So once they sit down with a human being that happens to be all those things, but first and foremost is a breathing, talking, flesh and blood person in front of your face, that's when human connection is where their ideology starts to fall apart.
Yeah, right? What's it like being, talking with them? Do you detect as they get to know you, obviously in a limited way, you haven't known the person for long and it's a fleeting thing, but is there a softening? Do you notice any change? I mean, are they capable of that?
They are. Some are not. I'm not going to, you know, say that every person has the capacity or potential for change. But what really shocked me in the process of making this film was not to learn how horrible the views of neo-Nazis and white supremacists are. We all know that. I know that. I don't need to go and make a film. I don't need to sit and listen to what a Nazi thinks to know what their, you know, ideology is and how awful it is. What shocked me was that after we spent, you know, quite a bit of time together, some of them started changing their mind about people like me. Some of them started questioning their entire worldview. And as a result, two of the men ended up leaving.
Wow.
One of them, in the course of making the film, I was editing the film in London, and he called me up and he said, look, and this is a man who's been committed to the white supremacist movement for decades. And we spent a lot of time together, and in the course of the film, you know, they were talking about, you know, they're going to build a white ethno state. That's what's going to happen. And I kept asking him, well, okay, but in reality, how do you accomplish that? You know, what will happen to the people like me who are already here? It's fine that you can close, you know, you say that you're going to close the doors to anyone new, but what about everyone that's already here, who's brown or black or, you know, whatever? And he said, well, you know, we'll have to figure that out. Maybe we'll pay people to leave. And I said, I have nowhere else to go. I was born and raised in the West. I have no other country to go to. This is all I know. So even if you pay me money, I'm not leaving. So what will you do with somebody like me who refuses to leave? And, you know, I said, you know, will you deport me? Will you, you know, exterminate people? You know, what will you do? And he, you know, didn't want to answer. He's like, oh, this is really uncomfortable. I don't really want to, you know. And I said, why is this uncomfortable? He said, well, you know, because I've kind of come to know you and it's really hard for me to put you in that position. And I said, but really, really, come on, you are talking about the white ethno state. How will you accomplish it? And he said, well, if it comes down to it, I am going to have to deport you. I am going to have to do whatever it takes, basically. Wow. So that's where we left. That's where I left him in the film. Then he calls me when I'm editing the film, and he said, look, I need to talk to you about something. And I call him up, and then I ended up filming this as well, and he knew that I was filming. And I said, you know, what is it that you want to share? And he said, look, I want to tell you that I've left. And I would, I mean, I get goosebumps even thinking about it.
Now. Yeah, how did you react to that? That must have been incredible to hear that.
I was stunned. As you can tell, I have a lot to say about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And I was utterly lost for words. Wow. Honestly, I mean, if you would have told me before I made that film that I'm going to end up making friends with people like that, I would have laughed at you, and I would have been quite offended that you would think I would even do that. But that's in reality what's ended up happening. I mean, he left, and the reason he left is he said he could no longer reconcile his worldview with how he came to feel about me. He came to view me as a friend.
Does that mean that if you engage, and this is one-on-one, I don't know if that's possible, there's so many people, but if you engage in that way, that you can walk back, you can walk it back that way. And I want to get on to the whole modern communication thing, because I think that's part of it as well. There are bubbles that people can exist in that reinforce their own thinking, and I guess these people exist in those bubbles. We all do, to varying degrees.
Yeah.
And one of the big things to come out of what happened here back in March is the Christchurch Call, which is the summit going on in Paris at the moment, and how to rein in this phenomenon. I think it comes back to social media, doesn't it? Let's be honest. The forms of social media have exploded this, made it bigger, made it more obvious. How would you characterize modern media's role in this?
I agree with you. I think, you know, as I say, you know, hate and white supremacy and these types of, you know, movements have been around for a long time. So that's not what's new. But what is new is the speed with which that they can now spread. You know, when I spoke to one of the neo-Nazis, you know, he's been in the movement for a really, really long time. And he said, look, when I first started out, it was really hard to locate other people who thought like me. And to join a group was really hard because it required a lot of effort to go and find people like that. Or you would have guys who would be standing outside of colleges or schools or whatever and be handing out, you know, like neo-Nazi leaflets or whatever. And he said, now it's a click away. You can sit in the comfort of your own home and you can instantly connect with other like-minded people all around the world. And you can also spread the literature, you can spread the propaganda. And you know, you were asking earlier, how do people, you know, sustain this type of thinking? It is to remain within their own bubbles. It is to remain within the echo chamber. So I think that social media, as much as it's had its wonderful, wonderful and incredibly important effects, it's also unfortunately accelerated the rate of radicalization and extremism and violence and the spread of hatred around the world. And we're seeing that on all spectrums of these various, you know, hate movements. You're seeing the same thing, you know, ISIS utilized it brilliantly and were able to recruit in a way that, you know, the jihadi side has never been able to recruit this fast. And we're seeing the same thing with white supremacy. However, and this is why, you know, going back to your question, can we do one-on-one? Can we, you know, sort of walk people back on a one-to-one basis? I think that absolutely has to be one of the solutions that we need to put on the table. And I think, yes, I think it would take a long time, but what alternative do we have? We have to engage. We have to try and dismantle these movements of hate through interrupting the hatred by injecting some sort of human connection, because that is where the change becomes possible. Just as much as the jihadis and the white supremacists have a lot in common in you know, what they are doing in these movements, why they are doing the things that they are, the other thing that they have in common is the reason why some of the men that I met eventually left both movements. And what the reason was interaction, was surprisingly positive, productive interactions with people that they hate. Now, I would like to clarify, though, I do not believe that it is the responsibility of abused or oppressed people, people who have been discriminated against, or minorities. It is not our responsibility to have to reform extremists and Nazis and racists. All I'm saying is I chose to engage, and I've seen very, very positive results from that. I have chosen to not engage for most of my life. I used to go to, you know, anti-fascist protests my whole life. I've thrown stuff at them. I've shouted stuff at them. I've yelled at them. I've flipped them off. I've done the whole thing, and it never did what engagement actually ended up doing.
Right.
So But in terms of social media, yes, I think it's absolutely put these movements on steroids. However, we cannot, the other, I think, factor that's essential to keep in mind is we are seeing the rise of populist politics absolutely everywhere. And I think we cannot underestimate the role of the kind of rhetoric that our politicians engage in. You know, it's the fact that, you know, a politics of fear and division and even a politics of hate is something that is becoming expedient for so many different politicians. And the fact that it's bearing fruits for so many politicians around the world is something that is a huge cause for concern.
Isn't that, though, a failure of legacy political systems? I mean, yes. One of the reasons you could argue that Donald Trump was elected the president was that there were a core of disaffected working class people who felt their jobs had been exported to other economies, that, you know, the elite, so-called, really, well, I think Hillary Clinton described them as deplorables. So they didn't like that. And that's happened in quite a few Western countries, which then puts people, average people, potentially in a mindset to be resentful, right? Against, first of all, politicians and others who are perceived to have benefited from their loss. That's a lot to unbundle, isn't it? That's a hell of a lot to unbundle.
It is a lot to unbundle, but I think this is where also the responsibility, you know, so I think we have responsibility on the media side of it, both social media and traditional media, that I think that, you know, we all need to be doing a better job on that front. I think there's a lot of responsibility in the hands of politicians who've been reckless and irresponsible with how they have wielded their platforms. And I think the rest of it also comes down to us. I think it comes down to individual citizens. I mean, all these men are a part of our communities. These are men who live in our streets, live in our communities, go to our schools, you know, work or don't work in our communities. And so it's also, I think, at some point, it becomes the responsibility of the rest of us as well to see how we can get, how we can become involved in this, in trying to reduce the potential for violence and the potential for further deepening and fracture, deepening of fear and fractures across our communities. The thing is, we have to be able to have difficult conversations about the fact that the world is changing very fast and some people are being left behind. And I agree with you. I think calling working class or the underclasses in America as deplorables, I think, is a tremendous mistake on the part of Hillary Clinton. These people, I mean, for good reasons or bad reasons or whatever, people feel forgotten and left behind. And why is it that the populace are speaking to that and not the rest of us? You know, we have to engage. If we don't engage, divisions will continue, fears and hatreds will deepen, and our communities and our countries will continue to fracture. We need all hands on deck, I believe, at this point. So I think it's up to all of us to do our little part in whatever ways that we can. Otherwise, I think this entire discourse we're handing over to the populists and to the far right. I mean, the thing that actually set off this film, the white supremacist film, was that I'd done an interview with the BBC about multiculturalism and about diversity and speaking about that. And one of the things that I was talking about in that is saying that we're going to have difficult conversations of what it means to live together, because that's, we have to find a way to live together, you know. And I understand that people from all over the world and different communities are sort of being shoved together and expected to just, you know, flourish and function in a good way. And that's not always that easy. You know, for example, things like honor killings do exist. You know, there are certain types of violence that exist within certain types of communities. There are certain fears that, you know, white people might have of brown people and that brown people might have, you know, all of that. We need to make it okay for people to have the feelings that they have. And we need to make it okay for people to ask questions and to say some of these things out loud so that we can address them and kind of get past some of these issues by actually confronting them. If we don't, this stuff will fester. You know, it'll fester in the darkness of, you know, the internet, and it'll fester in the darkness of just despair and anger and confusion in the hearts of people. And it will ultimately come out in violence unless we make it okay for people to say things out loud and explain to people why maybe some of the things that they think are actually misguided. But if we just shove it off to one side, those feelings aren't going to go away. And at this point, the only people that are willing to have some of these harder conversations of what it means to live together is the far right. But they're doing it, obviously, with completely different motivations of trying to separate and divide us all. Well, so the rest of us have to step in.
Even that term far right, and I'm only got a couple of minutes left. I hope I can squeeze just the last couple of questions in. But this term far right, it's interesting because in the way that people are reacting to these events and, you know, the Christchurch event, the Charlottesville event, these things, high profile, that are in people's faces, you're starting to see all sorts of people described as far right who probably aren't. You know, it's an overreach on description. I saw Jordan Peterson the other day described as far right. Well, if anyone's watched Jordan Peterson, he's not far right at all. It's crazy to suggest that. But that actually creates problems, doesn't it? Suddenly everyone's on all sides can be demonized at the lowest possible threshold, makes communication very difficult.
It does. It does. And that is something we absolutely must resist. And I understand the impulse to want to be like that. I understand it completely, but it's not productive. And the reality is what extremists want, whichever side they're on, they want us to become like them. And I know, as a woman of color, I know what it feels like to be demonized and to be stereotyped. I've had it done to me my entire life, which is part of the reason I refuse to do that to somebody else, even to somebody else who might hate me. Because to me, what we need is, rather than getting in this endless spiral of dehumanizing each other and becoming desensitized to each other's humanity, then there's no difference. If I'm willing to dehumanize these guys, then what is the difference between me and somebody like that? We have to interrupt the cycle of violence and hatred and of this self-righteous kind of indignation and judgment that, you know, patting myself on the back for having the correct opinions and the correct politics and the correct friends and all of that. We have to get past that. We have to start connecting to each other's humanity. We absolutely have to. If not, we're going to continue losing these guys to violence and hatred, which is only going to cycle back in the form of attacks against us, against the rest of us. You know, so they not only hurt themselves, but they also hurt us. So we have to refuse and resist the impulse to become like them. That is what they want. They want us to react with rage and anger and hate. In return, they want us, and that's one of the reasons why some of the men that changed in the film that I made changed, is because I refused to engage with them in the way that they wanted me to. They wanted me to be afraid of them. They wanted me to be angry and aggressive towards them. They know how to deal with that. They don't know how to deal with me treating them as a human being. Even when they refuse my humanity, I refuse to deny theirs.
Thanks so much for coming on the program. It's fascinating listening to you, and you're doing great work.
Thank you. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Film director, producer Dia Khan there, speaking about her latest television documentary, White Right, Meeting the Enemy. There are links on the Sunday morning page at rnz.co.nz to Dia's content and information.